Okay, we're going to go on to case number two, which is 081377, Star Insurance Company, et al. Versus Risk Marketing Group, et al. And Mr. Bennett. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Robert Bennett. I am the attorney for the appellants, the defendants in the underlying action before the district court. The principal issue for appellants, SEPCOR Service Corporation, Risk Marketing Group, Charles Stevenson, that is Mr. Charles Stevenson, Mr. Don Moore, Employ America, and Encompass Financial Solutions, is that the district court was in error when it imposed judgment against Mr. Charles Stevenson, Don Moore, Employ America, and Encompass Financial Solutions in the sum of $2,436,290. That's both individually and jointly. This judgment amount was entered in February 8, 2006, against both SEPCOR Service Corporation and Risk Marketing Group in the Eastern District of Michigan. That judgment was registered here in the Northern District of Illinois on March 13, 2006. It was a collection case, that is, an attempt by the plaintiffs to collect this judgment amount of $2,436,290 against SEPCOR Service Corporation and Risk Marketing Group. Judge Bucklow in the district court was the presiding judge over that matter. On March 25, 2007, the plaintiffs in that case, appellees before this court, filed a motion to set aside fraudulent transfers. They alleged that SEPCOR Service Corporation and Risk Marketing Group had fraudulently transferred assets of these two corporations, SEPCOR and Risk Marketing Group, to the appellants or defendants, Mr. Charles Stevenson, Mr. Don Moore, Employ America, and Encompass Financial Solutions. It was alleged that officer loans, quote, officer loans, end of quote, were made to Mr. Stevenson and Mr. Moore in the approximate sum of $536,000. The specific amount is $536,302.21. But nonetheless, the allegation was, that is, the plaintiff's appellee's motion was that this amount of money had been transferred from SEPCOR and Risk Marketing Group to these individuals, Mr. Stevenson, Mr. Moore, and also the two individual corporations, Employ America and Encompass Financial Solutions. In addition to that, that motion to set aside fraudulent transfers alleged that the corporations, these are limited liability corporations, Employ America, LLC, and Encompass Financial Solutions, LLC, had received loans from SEPCOR and Risk Marketing Groups, each in the approximate sum of $1,200,000. Now, on June the 29th, 2007, the plaintiffs filed a second lawsuit, that is, the appellees in this matter, filed a second lawsuit. This lawsuit named, it included the exact same plaintiffs as in the collection case. It included seven of the eight defendants or respondents who had been parties to or made allegations were made against in this matter that was pending before Judge Bucklow.
Well, your principal argument on appeal is that Judge Bucklow should have consolidated the supplemental proceeding with the case before Judge St. Eve. And my question would be, how were the defendants prejudiced by Judge Bucklow's refusal to consolidate the two cases?
Good question, Your Honor. That goes exactly to the heart of the matter here. Judge Bucklow ruled, she denied the motion to consolidate or in alternative to transfer. She specifically stated that she would not consolidate because the matter before Judge St. Eve, that is the second lawsuit, was a piercing the corporate veil lawsuit. And the matter before her was a supplementary proceeding, that is a collection proceeding. And in a supplementary or collection proceeding, it is not proper for the court to pierce the corporate veil. So therefore, the judge, Judge Bucklow, in making that statement, said that the two cases should be separate. However, on January 23rd, 2007, Judge Bucklow, in fact, pierced the corporate veil. What the district court did was to impose judgment against these individual defendants in the sum of the judgment against SEPCOR and RMG, that is Risk Marketing Group, the $2,436,000. It was not possible for the court to impose such a judgment against these individuals or these parties without, in fact, piercing the corporate veil. The corporate veil, of course, or the corporate shield, protects the corporate officers and those who operate or run a corporation so long as the corporate formalities are observed. There was never any evidence before the court, never any suggestion by the plaintiffs in the underlying case before Judge Bucklow that any of the corporate formalities had not been observed. In other words, the plaintiffs simply sought a return of the allegedly transferred assets. In other words, the transferred assets to Mr. Stevenson and Mr. Moore, for example, was $536,000. So that's what should have been returned to them. Judge Buck returned to SEPCOR and RMG, or Risk Marketing Group. So that was Judge Bucklow's order on August 31st, that the monies or assets allegedly transferred to Charles Stevenson and Mr. Moore in the amount of $536,000 should be returned to SEPCOR and RMG, Risk Marketing Group, so that they in turn could satisfy the judgment of $2,436,000.
Why do we have jurisdiction to review that August 31st?
Could you speak a little louder?
Why do we have jurisdiction to review that that order of Judge Bucklow?
Could you use the microphone? I can't hear you.
August 31st. Judge of 07, Judge Bucklow issued this decision, an order, and I'm questioning whether we have jurisdiction to review that by your February of 08 notice of appeal.
Exactly, Your Honor. Judge Bucklow's order, of course, was entered, as Your Honor correctly stated, August 31st, 2007. September 21, 2007, I, as attorney for the defendants, filed a motion to reconsider. On October 1st, 2007, the district court of Judge Bucklow, denied the motion to reconsider. And at the same time that the motion to reconsider was denied, she granted or allowed the plaintiffs, appellees before this court, an opportunity to file a response to the motion to reconsider, which she had just denied. They did so on October 16th, 2007. On October 19th, 2007, Judge Bucklow entered yet another order with regard to motions that had been filed. And on October 30th, I filed the notice of appeal, which was timely filed, following the denial of the court's motion to reconsider on October 1st, 2007. This court, on November 2nd, 2007, issued an order stating that, in its opinion, or suggesting that, the appeal at that time was premature. I have a copy of that order. States that the district court has not entered a Rule 58 judgment in the present case, and it is not clear that the district court has disposed of all of plaintiff's claims against all defendants. Further, there is no indication that the district court has disposed of defendants' counterclaims. As such, it appears that this appeal is premature. So the court in its order gave me or defendants the option of either filing a memorandum of law to brief the court on why this matter should be heard by the court on appeal at that particular time, or to voluntarily dismiss it, the appeal. I chose the voluntary dismissal, knowing that I would have an opportunity to appeal at a later date, and that's exactly what I did. When Judge Bucklow issued her final order on January 23, 2008, imposing this judgment against these parties, that's when I timely filed the notice of appeal.
And in your view, then, that notice of appeal brought up all these other orders?
Again, I couldn't understand.
In your view, that notice of appeal then brought up all these other
orders?
Yes,
Your Honor, that's exactly so. I believe that covers all of these different issues. In other words, again, it goes back to Judge Bucklow's decision, the district court's decision, goes back to the entire issue of whether or not the cases should have been consolidated in the first place. District court is not going to consolidate, not going to transfer, then this particular district court, Judge Bucklow, could not rule. She could not pierce the corporate veil, which, in fact, she did in order to impose a judgment against these individuals for this entire sum of money. If any judgment should have been imposed against these individuals, we're not saying that one should have. It should have been in the sum of $536,000, not $2,436,000. The one case that the plaintiffs rely on in stating that this full amount of the judgment should be imposed against these individuals and against this corporation is a case called Kennedy versus Four Boys Labor Service. That case is very different from the case that is before this court. It is different because, for a number of reasons. One is that in that case, number one, the corporation that was at issue here, Four Boys Labor Service Corporation, had been dissolved or was a defunct corporation, no longer in existence at the time that the court was deciding the matter. In addition to that, the sole shareholder of the Four Boys Corporation received all of the assets of the corporation, all of the value of the corporation, and transferred all of those assets to four relatives. And when she transferred all of those assets of the corporation to the four relatives, she had an indemnity agreement with the four relatives that guaranteed that the four relatives would reimburse her or cover any liability which she had or would incur as a result of this judgment that the plaintiffs were trying to collect. Now, the sole shareholder had received was only receiving $10,000 from as consideration for transferring the assets. So the trial court had asked or required that this particular defendant return those assets, that is the $10,000. That's what she was receiving. But the court issued a judgment for greater amount than that, for $82,000, which was a bit more than the actual judgment which the plaintiff had received or obtained from the court. So why would the court issue a judgment for that amount of money? When the actual amount transferred, that is received by the defendant, was only $10,000. Why shouldn't she just return only $10,000? Why would the court say she had to return $82,000? Return $82,000 because this sole shareholder still had control of all of the assets of this corporation. In other words, this court in Kennedy versus Four Boys Labor Service said there's a continuity between seller and buyer. And where there's this continuity between seller and buyer, there has been no disposal of the assets. Where there's an indemnification agreement, there's been no disposal of the assets. In other words, this one defendant, this sole shareholder who had possession of all the assets and had transferred all the assets, she never lost control of those assets. That's not the situation before this court in this case. Mr. Stevenson, Mr. Moore, as alleged by the plaintiffs, only received a total of $536,000. They didn't receive $2,436,000. That was the amount that the plaintiffs had as a judgment against SEPCOR and RMG. Mr. Stevenson and Mr. Moore, for example, only received allegedly received $536,000 from SEPCOR and Risk Marketing Group. Why should they have to return $2,436,000 but for the piercing of the corporate veil? And that's exactly what this court did.
You know, Mr. Bennett, I see that you asked for no rebuttal time.
Speak a little louder, ma'am.
I'm sorry. I see where you asked for no rebuttal time. Do you still want no...
Yes, I would like to have that, Your Honor.
Well, then stop right now.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
And I'll give you a minute. Mr. McCoy?
McCory, John McCory, for the appellees. C-C-O-R-R-Y. I believe the name was misspelled on the sheet out there. I saw that.
Misspelled all over it.
So it's McCrory.
Yes, M-C-C-O-R-R-Y.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry?
You're very clearly spelled out on your brief.
Yeah.
I have a name that's often misspelled for leaving out letters.
Okay.
Thank you, and may it please the court. I am the attorney for the appellees and plaintiffs below, and we ask this court to affirm the decision of the district court. There are three main issues here on appeal. The first issue is one that we brought up, the jurisdiction of this court over any orders other than that of January 23, 2008. The judgment debtors, defendants below, did not timely appeal the orders of August 31, 2007, October 1, 2007, and October 19,
2007. In fairness to them, yeah. Though, when they receive an order from this court questioning whether the appeals, that the notices appeal are premature, and they elect to withdraw and continue in the district court and then come up later with this February appeal, why shouldn't we look at it from their perspective?
You understand
that. Consider that we have all jurisdiction over all of these orders.
You understand that throws an interesting twist into this issue. However, this is a post-judgment proceeding, so it is handled somewhat differently from a judgment from an actual case. So this has been an attempt for 3 years now to collect a judgment pursuant to Rule 69 and Illinois Supreme Court Rule 277. The controlling decisions from the Seventh Circuit on this issue are Resolution Trust Corporation versus Ruggiero and Laborers Pension Fund versus Dirty Work Incorporated. And both of those cases make clear that the judgments for turnover orders, which the order of August 31st, 2007 was, are final and appealable orders. In addition, as part of the August 31st, 2007 order, the district court also entered a preliminary injunction against Sevcore Service Corporation and Risk Marketing Group, which itself is an appealable interlocutory order pursuant to 28 U.S.C. 1292A1.
Yeah, but the fact that some aspects of her August 31st order may have been final and immediately appealable doesn't alter the interlocutory nature of her decision to deny consolidation. So it would seem that the defendants properly waited until after the conclusion of the supplemental proceedings to appeal.
Well, the supplemental proceedings have not been concluded. That is why the court in Ruggiero and Dirty Work said that there may be proceedings. We are still attempting to collect the judgment. And
what's the status before Judge St. Eve?
We are in the process of discovery right now. We have just filed a second amended complaint. The plaintiffs have to add additional parties, which we discovered recently. And a discovery is set to close on January 30th, 2009. That is the status of that. Turning to the consolidation issue, assuming that that particular order was not appealable on August 31st, 2007, or the 30 days, after that. That doesn't affect the appealability of the other issues. And as the court in Ruggiero addressed, this court would have had pendent appellate jurisdiction over the motion to the denial of the motion to consolidate.
But why would we? Why would we want to, you know, piecemeal this out like a patchwork quilt of some sort?
Well, because until the actual judgment is satisfied or some other action is taken, such as a bankruptcy, there are attempts continued ongoing to collect the judgment. So as I believe Judge Posner had said, I'm trying to remember the exact case, he had said it there, that the issues on the post-judgment proceedings do not raise the same concerns of piecemeal litigation that you might have when you are in a case that where you are attempting to get to a judgment. A judgment here has been entered, and there may be several different rulings by the court, each of them separately appealable. Now, it could result in the fact that certain appeals taken at different times could be consolidated before this court, but it doesn't change the fact that the order of August 31st, 2007 was appealable on the date that it was entered. And similarly, the order of October 19th, 2007 was appealable as well, because that appointed a receiver, which is an appealable interlocutory order under 1292A2. However, assuming...
What if we had just entered an order not just questioning jurisdiction, but dismissing those cases, the earlier appeals, saying we had no jurisdiction?
Actually, the order, it was a rule to show cause why there was not jurisdiction. So the appeals were not dismissed. Frankly, the appellants could have made these arguments at that time to show that the court had jurisdiction, point to Ruggiero, point to laborers' pension fund, and there would have been jurisdiction over the order, at least the orders of October 1st, 2007 and October 19th, 2007. The order of August 31st, 2007 would still have been untimely, since the appeal was filed almost 2 months
after that
order.
I think you need to go back and look at Helene Curtis Industry versus Church and Dwight Company. That's a 77 Seventh Circuit case that notes order separating issues for trial pursuant to Rule 42B not immediately appealable.
I understand that.
Rule 42A order, you know, that was a procedural interlocutory order, and as such it wasn't appealable prior to final judgment. Here that would be the final resolution of the supplementary proceeding.
Well,
so I don't understand your argument.
Well, there are two separate. The August 31st, 2007 order was final, because had the fraudulent transferees returned those amounts to SEBCOR and Risk Marketing Group, who then used those amounts to satisfy the judgment, there would have been nothing left for the court to do. And then the supplement scheme would have been over. They did not do that, so then the plaintiffs had to bring the next motion, first to appoint a receiver and to judicially dissolve SEBCOR and Risk Marketing Group, and then ask the court to enter judgment against the fraudulent transferees for failing to comply with the August 31st, 2007 order, which then was a separate...
Assuming we're all obtuse, why don't you go ahead with the principal argument with the assumption that there is jurisdiction?
That's exactly what I was going to do next, Your Honor. Thank
That's
you very much.
That's what I'd do right now if I were you.
Thank you, yes.
Okay, so I have a question to start you off.
Yes, please.
Because you've cited Illinois law in support of the notion that it was appropriate to hold the defendants jointly and severally liable for the full amount of the judgment as a sanction for their failure to comply with Judge Bucklow's order to return the allegedly fraudulently transferred assets. Why shouldn't we be looking to federal laws to the propriety of such a sanction, given that we're in federal court?
Well, that issue is actually discussed in the Laborers' Pension Fund versus Dirty Work case. There, the Seventh Circuit approved of the district court employing Illinois Supreme Court Rule 277H in holding the citation respondent in contempt for failing to turn over amounts that were ordered to be turned over. And the Rule 69 states that state law is to be employed in post-judgment proceedings unless there is a federal statute. There being no federal statute that controls in this situation, we would turn to Section 214.02 of the Illinois Code of Civil Procedure and Illinois Supreme Court Rule 277, and specifically in this case, Rule 277H, and that as interpreted by the Illinois Appellate Court in Kennedy versus Four Boys Labor. Mr. Bennett misstated the facts and the holding of that case. Frankly, the existence of the indemnification agreement was not controlling in the court's deciding that. The court looked to the inherent ability of the court to enforce its orders, and because the citation respondent in that case had not turned over the monies that the court ordered, the court entered judgment for the full amount of the judgment that was due, even though the citation respondent did not owe that full amount as a sanction. So the Seventh Circuit in Laborers' Pension Fund has recognized the propriety of following Rule 277 in post-judgment proceedings and in sanctioning recalcitrant citation respondents.
Let me just make sure I understand your previous argument. You are, or are you saying, that state law governs the question of sanctions in a federal action such as this?
In a post-judgment proceeding, it is the court has the discretion to follow Rule 277. As the Seventh Circuit has discussed, the procedures in post-judgment proceedings are a little bit looser than if you had a motion for summary judgment in a case before you reach judgment.
Are you arguing that the court has the choice
to
choose federal or state?
Yes. And the court properly exercised its discretion in entering judgment against the fraudulent transferees. And there has been no showing by the appellants that the district court abused its discretion. Their only argument in their motion to reconsider, which order they did not appeal either, but for the sake of argument, say that this is in front of that court, their only argument was that there were no fraudulent transfers. They did not argue that the judge abused its discretion by applying Rule 277 in the post-judgment
proceeding.
I agree
with that, but I'm a bit puzzled about the others. So
this is a very long and winding procedural and factual situation. We're approaching 3 years now in attempting to collect the judgment. And again, in that instance, the Ruggiero case is instructive because it deals with a lot of these issues. First, with the jurisdiction of the appellate court over post-judgment proceedings and the behavior of judgment debtors who do not want to pay the judgment. Most of the behavior that the Seventh Circuit found to be improper in Ruggiero has been the same, exists here in this case as well. Judge Bucklow has provided two opportunities for SEBCOR and Misc Marketing Group and the fraudulent transferees to address the motion to declare certain transfers fraudulent. They did not respond. Then they file an untimely motion to reconsider 21 days after that order is filed. Then they file a motion asking for an evidentiary hearing. That is denied. We file our motion to have judgment entered against the fraudulent transferees. There was no response filed. And then they filed a motion to reconsider, which did not present any new information to the court that could not have been presented before. Judge Bucklow exercised discretion and prudence in allowing the judgment debtors to respond to these. And her decision, all of her decisions along the way were well thought out and well reasoned and based upon the facts that the plaintiffs put in the record, the records and accounting entries and other documents that the judgment debtors themselves produced and failed to address.
Wouldn't
in any
a
of their
lot
written
of this
meetings.
Have been taken care of if indeed the cases had been consolidated? I mean, even if we accept that a corporate veil can't be pierced in a supplemental proceeding, why would that have precluded consolidating a supplemental proceeding with a non-supplemental proceeding in which the veil could be pierced? I mean, look at the mess.
Well, I don't know if there's a mess, but there would not have been any prejudice to the defendants if these had been consolidated. The law in the Seventh Circuit following Illinois law is that piercing the corporate veil cannot be consolidated with a post-judgment proceeding. But if they could be, the plaintiffs still could have proceeded with their motion to declare transfers fraudulent and then proceeded separately whether additional discovery was needed or filing a motion to pierce the corporate veil as well. So they're honestly, the result would be the same here. I do think it is cleaner to keep the piercing the corporate veil and the post-judgment proceeding separate because they are attempting to accomplish two separate things. Thank you.
We're going to give you 2 minutes because you had 1 minute left when I interrupted you. And then...
Thank you, Your Honor. Just take a minute or two.
Give more than a minute if people don't ask for it.
Yeah, just a little. First off, a lot of what Mr. McCrory is saying with regard to the motion to consolidate is very new. New to me and I believe new to this court in the sense that Mr. McCrory or the plaintiffs did not file a response to the motion to consolidate or an alternative to transfer the case. That they did not do. So much of what he's saying now was not before Judge Bucklow, was not presented before Judge Bucklow, and so I did not have an opportunity to even respond to such, and Judge Bucklow in her ruling did not raise these issues at all. The other point is that the January 23, 2008 judgment in itself, as I said earlier, it ties back or relates back to this entire issue of whether or not to consolidate or the transfer. That is to make one case out of the two. Because a judgment was issued for the full amount of the money, the $2,436,000, when only the amount transferred was $536,000. So even if the defendants had that kind of money in cash to transfer back, that is $536,000, that's the most that they would have had to transfer. Thank you, Your Honor. No.
All right. Thank you very much to one and all, and the case will be taken under advisement.